From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Will Vladimir Putin send Russian troops into eastern Ukraine? Will Malaysia Air Flight 370 be located before its flight data recorder stops pinging? Can the Israel-Palestinian peace talks be revived? Who cares? The big questions at week's end concerned the retirement of Late Show host David Letterman and Stephen Colbert's ascension to his chair.
But guys like us, we don't pay attention to the polls. We know that polls are just a collection of statistics that reflect what people are thinking in reality. And reality has a well-known liberal bias.
The first riddle is how comfortable the politically diverse audience of network TV will be with a comedian so associated with the political left. Colbert, in the character of a right-wing blowhard, has used irony as a bludgeon against conservative Republicans for 9 years.
I'm sure you agree with me that it is a proud day to be an American because thanks to a minority of the U.S. Senate, we no longer have to live in fear of some maniac coming after those we love with a gun control bill.
How might such satire play at 11:30 p.m. in Kansas and Oklahoma? Well, at least one actual right-wing blowhard says it isn't meant to.
CBS has just declared war on the heartland of America. No longer is comedy going to be a covert assault on traditional American values, conservatives. Now it's just wide out in the open. It's media planting a flag here.
Let's just assume that CBS, a profit-making enterprise, isn't actually plotting to alienate exactly half of the network's late-night audience. There remains the question of who even will be hosting late night. The preening pretend ideologue Colbert won't be filling the chair. Instead, it will be occupied by the inveterate comedian Colbert, rarely glimpsed since his emergence as a star in 1997 on The Daily Show. Here's the genuine Colbert in 2007 with Tim Russert on Meet the Press.
Is it hard going in and out of character?
No. I started at Second City in Chicago, and the rule there, or the old saying was, wear your character as lightly as a cap.
Maybe he does wear his character lightly as a cap, but I take it's passing hard. Here's Colbert with Letterman in 2005, just before launching The Rapport.
And the type of thing you'll be doing on the show?
Changing the world, you know.
Wow.
The people are clamoring for
the world change.
For me, I've been on The Daily Show for years, but...
How long do you think it'll take you to change the world there?
I think we have an 8-week initial commitment. Uh-huh.
Many said it couldn't be done, a one-note character sustaining a show night after night after night.
Now, I know some of you may not trust your gut yet, but with my help, you will. The truthiness is, anyone can read the news to you. I promise to feel the news at you.
Who could have imagined what a many splendored thing it could be? Not just for skewering the right, but the nation's increasingly splenetic zeitgeist that fosters the accretion of balderdash, which he confronts right at the source, and for just a moment, shames and shrivels it.
I am happy to use my celebrity to draw attention to this important, complicated issue, and I certainly hope that my star power can bump this hearing all the way up to C-SPAN 1.
Legislators sat glumly at this subcommittee hearing on, quote, protecting America's harvest.
I don't want a tomato picked by a Mexican. I want it picked by an American, then sliced by a Guatemalan, and served by a Venezuelan in a spa where a Chilean gives me a Brazilian.
Hardly anyone laughed.
My great-grandfather did not travel across 4,000 miles of the Atlantic Ocean to see this country overrun by immigrants. He did it because he killed a man back in Ireland.
It was hilariously painful.
I trust that following my testimony, both sides will work together in the best interest of the American people, as you always do.
Stephen Colbert is a brilliant comedian who uses his powers for good. He seems to be a modest man, too modest perhaps, to see that by lightly shedding the cap of his creation, he's depriving us all of a national treasure. And I'm not joking. Have you noticed that lately, Democrats are all talking about family. I mean, a particular family.
Democrats are fighting for a fair shot for everyone, while Republicans are doing the bidding of the Koch brothers.
The people in North Carolina are not going to let the billionaire Koch brothers buy this seat.
This week's talking point is David and Charles Koch, founders of Koch Industries. Through their PAC, Americans for Prosperity, the brothers have spent at least $30 million supporting Republicans in crucial Senate and House races around the country in this election cycle. Democrats are fighting back by attacking not just the message, but the messengers. Here's an ad that ran in Alaska.
I'm Mark Begich, and I approve this message.
First, it was a D.C. actress pretending to be an Alaskan. Now, ads attacking Mark Begich on a carbon tax have been called false and not true. Who's behind the attacks?
The Koch brothers.
The billionaire Koch brothers.
I do not believe it.
They come into our town, fire a refinery.
Just running it into the ground.
Leaving a mess.
A lot of Alaskans are losing jobs.
In February, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid lobbed a red-hot soundbite.
They're trying to buy America, and it's time that the American people spoke out against this terrible dishonesty of these two brothers who are about as un-American as anyone that I can imagine.
Charles Koch served up a rare public riposte with a Wall Street Journal op-ed charging the attacks were unfair and that his opponents were, well, the C word. It was catchy. Kansas Republican Senator Jerry Moran.
Collectivists, those who stand for government control of means of production and how people live their lives, promise heaven but deliver hell.
So Reid attacked again, saying that the Republicans might as well wear Koch insignias because, quote, they display their sponsors proudly through their actions in the Senate. Clearly, the Dems have decided that Koch is it, a move driven, said New York Times political reporter Carl Hulse, by the upcoming midterm elections where control of the Congress is at stake.
For the Republicans, the Senate is the big prize. They're getting a big boost from the Kochs. I think the Democrats were slow to recognize it, and now they realize they're up against a very formidable opponent, and they're pretty upfront about it. They are trying to draw the Kochs into a public war. They want people to know that forces behind these ads that they're seeing all the time, and they are seeing a lot of them, represent a company that, for instance, in North Carolina, just laid off 100 workers last year. I think the big challenge for the Democrats is, can you make a boogeyman out of people who aren't really on the ballot?
I guess they think the Kochs are wonderful stand-ins for the Republican Party. You have Democrats labeling the Ryan budget the Koch budget, and the Republican dream is Kochtopia.
Kochtopia is actually my favorite. They're trying to basically make the Republican Party look like the toadies of the Koch brothers. Their agenda is being set by the Kochs, and that obviously as major industrialists who run these big energy companies, they don't have the same interests that the middle class. And they're going to push that and push that. The Democrats have been planning to call the Ryan budget the Koch budget for at least the last month. And the press releases that were issued on Thursday when the House finally passed the Ryan budget referred to it as the Koch budget and the Koch spending plan. So they are really trying to join them at the hip.
Underneath all of these tactics and strategies, there does seem to be some real arguments, for instance, about what constitutes free speech. I mean, the Republicans say that the Democrats are attacking the rights of citizens to freely speak, and the Democrats argue that unconstrained campaign spending and the anonymity that protects the deep pocket contributors distorts that debate and that it isn't free, that in fact it's phenomenally expensive.
I think that the Republicans do find an audience when they make the case that these businessmen are entitled to speak out. They lose people when Democrats are able to say, well, we don't even know who for sure is behind these ads. We know the Kochs are part of them because they've been public, but it's not free speech where people are standing up and saying, I'm behind this.
The argument seems to be, should the playing field be leveled so that everybody has a fair chance at being heard, or should the free market be allowed to decide who gets to set the terms of the debate?
I think that's the debate that's going on. I agree that people should be able to, if they have the wherewithal, to engage in political campaigns to whatever level they can afford.
And what about the people who don't have any money?
Well, they need to find another way. I think under our system, I'm not saying I would advocate for that system, but under our system, they need to find a way to be heard, and whether that's through more grassroots politics, forming groups that can act on their behalf. But, you know, politics is a struggle, and you have to find your way to be heard above the fray.
That's why I think that this is fundamentally a proxy argument about what America is supposed to be. I mean, you're seeing it in the vocabulary. Either the Koch brothers are private citizens or they're plutocrats. Either they are un-American or their critics are collectivist, which sounds like communist.
I think that was what sort of was meant there. And it's a clash of titans in some ways between Harry Reid and the Koch brothers. So you have both sides who are trying to use that kind of inflamed language sort of to get under the skin of the other one. And it works to a degree.
It's so weird that these titans you talk about all look like Mr. Peepers.
I have heard people, they reference those Muppet characters that are in the balcony.
Is this going to go away after the election?
No, this is all a precursor to 2016. The groups affiliated with the Kochs, they want to be a long-term force in American politics. They didn't have a great 2012. Barack Obama remained president. They lost some of the Senate races they were involved in. They set out in a very business-like way to review their operations. They're setting up permanent organizations around the country. They were not involved in a Florida House special election that happened earlier this year, but they went down there and used that electoral atmosphere to test out some of their tactics and messages. They're very upfront about the fact that they want to change the way people think about government.
But they're not upfront about what organizations they support.
You can find out which organizations the Kochs have given to, either from them or through the people who are on the board of those organizations. But what you can't find out, how much everyone's giving and who the other givers are. There's a group called the Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce. This is a group you're going to start to hear more about. Gave over $200 million to a lot of conservative organizations. Now Freedom Partners is actually doing ads themselves. First time this week, they've gotten involved in some races.
And are those people known?
We know that the Koch family's involved. We know that some of their executives are involved. But we don't know who the other people are who are donating.
Can you predict where this is going to go?
A lot of this is a precursor to the presidential race. Right now, we're in a period where there's going to be a lot of big money from billionaire donors flowing into these races because they can actually have a really huge impact, and it's not a giant expense for them. For the Koch brothers, they've already spent, you know, obviously over $30 million. That's probably underestimating what's been spent so far already in the midterms. And it's not a huge hit. In some ways, it's a very affordable way to be effective.
Carl, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Carl Hulse is a political reporter for the New York Times.
Coming up, South Africa has arrived. It has a celebrity murder trial and a 24/7 channel to cover it.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Hover, helping you get the best domain names along with all the tools and support you need to manage them. When you want to get your ideas on the internet, Hover will help you find the right domain name to personalize your blog, business, portfolio, or cat videos. For 10% off your first purchase, go to hover.com and type in the promo code TRUTH.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Every year on or around April 13th, Thomas Jefferson's birthday, the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression has celebrated by issuing Jefferson muzzles. These are booby prizes awarded to individuals and institutions who act against Mr. Jefferson's admonition that freedom of speech, quote, cannot be limited without being lost. This year's winners range from many federal agencies to police departments to schools. No institution is too large or too small to avoid the muzzle. Josh Wheeler, who directs the center, says the first muzzle went to the Department of Justice for the overzealous pursuit of leakers.
In one incident, they subpoenaed the phone records of several Associated Press offices and journalists. without informing the AP that they were planning to do this. The only time they're really supposed to do that without giving warning is when there's a danger that those records could be destroyed. Well, there's absolutely no danger of that here. The records were held by Verizon. But more troubling was
James Rosen.
Right. James Rosen, exactly.
A reporter for Fox News was named as a co-conspirator in a criminal case.
Get a subpoena of someone's emails to actually read the content, they had to get a search warrant. And in order to get a search warrant, there was a requirement that the person that they were seeking the information from had to be someone who was under investigation for criminal activity. That's a sad day for freedom of the press when a reporter can be considered a criminal for simply doing their job.
One way to muzzle journalism is ex post facto, such as in the Rosen case, but journalism can also be stymied at its source. Tell me about the White House photographers.
The Obama White House policy has been not to give reporters access to presidential meetings and private affairs, but instead give them official photographs that staff photographers take. And the news organizations wrote a combined letter saying, this is ridiculous. You're deciding what images we get to use and planning on us to distribute those for you. This is in contrast to what other presidential administrations have done. And the Obama administration justifies it by saying they give out more photographs than any administration has in the past. Well, it is a different thing from journalists taking the photographs.
The federal government had a year like Avatar, practically a sweep. You gave muzzles to other agencies as well, a National Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security. Incredibly, some smaller governmental bodies managed to break through. Tell me about the North Carolina General Assembly, please.
Sure. A reporter for the Charlotte Observer was covering what had become a weekly protest at the General Assembly of North Carolina. These protests were in response to some budget cuts that they felt unfairly targeted programs for the poor. The reporter for the Charlotte Observer was interviewing the protesters. The police said, we're going to start arresting people to disperse. And the reporter, of course, stayed there to cover the story. And even though he had his press credentials clearly out and he clearly identified himself, the police handcuffed him and held him in a holding cell for several hours before he was able to be released. Talk about a chilling effect. If reporters are going to start to be arrested for covering the news, then we're in very sad shape.
We have seen some high-profile cases of people's mic being cut off. Kill the mic when you don't like what you're hearing. Bill O'Reilly has famously done it with guests who discussed him. But you gave a muzzle to someone in education for cutting off debate.
It was a high school graduation ceremony in Tampa, Florida, in which the salutatorian was giving his speech. Well, apparently this young man had been critical of the high school, most notably about the condition of the high school's bathrooms. And he had wanted to mention that in his speech. Well, the school required that he submit his text of his speech beforehand, and they did not approve that reference to the bathrooms. So he took it out. But during his speech, he stumbled over a few words. You could see on video that Principal Wood was following along with a script. And when the young man stumbled over his words, it appears that the principal assumed he was going off script and stood up and makes a slashing gesture across his neck, and they cut the young man's microphone. Think about this from the young man's point of view. This is his high school graduation. His family, his friends are all there. And this principal, he embarrasses the young man. We think that fear of speech deserved recognition with the Jefferson muzzle.
Now, when you get a muzzle, it's not just the glory of it. You actually receive a prize.
We send each of the recipients a Jefferson muzzle T-shirt, which has an image of our third president with what is essentially a muzzle over his mouth. We've come up with these little taglines for each of these muzzles that hopefully inspire some laughter. For example, for the college that prevented the young man from passing out constitutions on Constitution Day, their motto is Modesto Junior College, taking the Constitution out of Constitution Day. the high school newspaper that was censoring the student comments, the Stinger News, none of the news that's fit to print. They sounded a lot funnier to us when we were doing it.
Cut this guy's mic. Cut his mic. Josh Wheeler is the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression. This week, the world watched as South African Paralympics hero and accused murderer Oscar Pistorius testified in his own defense on the shooting death of his girlfriend, Reeva Steenkamp.
My lady, that's the moment that everything changed. I thought that there was a burglar that was gaining entry into my home.
The courtroom spectacle is a first for South Africa, which, at least until now, lacked the crime and punishment media infrastructure that has grown here since the 1995 O.J. Simpson media circus. No court TV, no Nancy Grace, no Judge Judy even. But the Pistorius case demanded solutions, and there is one. The Oscar Pistorius Trial Channel, a pop-up satellite TV channel devoted 24/7 to the trial. George Mazarakis heads the channel. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Bob.
This is not just a camera and a technician. Can you tell me how many people are involved and doing what?
It comes to about 189 people. We have cameras in court, but we don't have them manned. It was quite important to us to put unmanned cameras in court. We have a team in Pretoria outside the court and on a roof nearby where we've set up a studio and a major studio in Johannesburg with anchors and a full plethora of evening analytical shows. The signal from court is distributed to everybody who wants it.
To get approval from the court to broadcast from within the courtroom itself, that's a pretty high hurdle. How did you get the permission?
Well, it was quite a process, and our approach was basically that, A, we would provide a fully dedicated channel which would allow us to cover all the content live, unedited, and during the course of the night, we would repeat the entire proceedings of court unedited, allowing us then to do analytical work in between, which we felt would be to the benefit of the general public. And that was partially responsible for the state giving us their support.
Now, they did not give you exactly carte blanche. There are some limitations to what you can broadcast from the trial. Can you tell me what you cannot do?
The Pistorius team opposed us on absolutely everything. And one of the things we can't do is actually show Oscar during his evidence and cross-examination. Nor can we show any witnesses who didn't want to be seen.
We hear the audio feed, but we don't see their faces.
Exactly. So we were allowed the audio and we were allowed the images of the rest of the courtroom. And it's worked remarkably well. It's the theater of the mind, I suppose, because you see the advocates asking the questions and you see the judges' reactions and you see the reactions of the rest of the people in the courtroom, but you don't get to see the witness. And in Oscar's case, we don't get to see him crying, but we certainly hear him and we hear him reaching and vomiting and whatever it is that he was doing.
If the trial telecast itself is unfiltered, there is plenty of opportunity for filtering in the reporting and the commentary that goes on between courtroom sessions. There is the risk that it becomes a kind of pulp nonfiction. How straight are you playing it?
We play it terribly straight. We've been very careful about taking a serious analytical look through the eyes of legal experts, legal academics, former judges, and the top criminal lawyers in the country. The audience has taken to it with great gusto, I think mainly because most people are familiar with perhaps American television dramas and sometimes BBC television dramas, and they've seen other judicial systems at play. But most ordinary people aren't familiar with the legal processes even within their own country. It's really gripped the public imagination. People, you know, literally missing work in order to be at home for when Oscar Pistorius himself is on the stand. And I think it's partially because it's a straight down the line take on it rather than a tabloid approach.
Now that you have this infrastructure built and you have educated the South African audience how to watch real-life trials. Do you think there's an ongoing market for this kind of coverage? And if yes, do you feel confident that the producers can resist the temptation to go down the tabloid road?
Most certainly there's an appetite in the audience for more of this kind of material, and we as producers certainly intend to develop it further. I think it's vitally important in a modern democracy and a brand new one, such as the South African one, where our freedoms are newly won, that we protect this particular right just as we do all our other constitutional rights. And for that reason, and given that, in fact, it is still up to a trial judge to say yes or no to coverage, as long as that particular control is adhered to by the judicial system, I think the media will have no choice but to behave.
George, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
George Mazarakis is the executive producer of the Carte Blanche program and of the pop-up Oscar Pistorius Trial Channel.
Monday marked the 20th anniversary of the start of the Rwandan genocide. In the massacre, which took place over 100 days, more than 800,000 minority Tutsis were slaughtered by members of the Hutu majority. This week, mourners collapsed in grief during a commemoration in Kigali. In 2001, Nick Hughes directed and co-produced 100 Days, the first feature film depicting the 1994 genocide. It was shot at the actual scene of mass murder with people who had actually been there and seen it all. But it isn't a documentary. Hughes and his co-producer Eric Cabera, who lost 32 family members during those 100 days, sought a new way to tell the story, so they hired witnesses, Tutsis and Hutus, as actors.
Get rid of women and their baby rats. Don't leave any rats for the future. The time for work is now. What we have waited for is happening.
When I spoke with director Nick Hughes in 2002, I asked him why he decided to tell the story of such a dramatic historical event as a fictional drama.
I worked on so many documentaries after the genocide, and in many ways a documentary is the best way to tell the history of such an enormous event as the genocide in Rwanda. But documentaries about Rwanda aren't watched, and 100 Days is made to explain in a dramatic form, to explain what happened in Rwanda to an audience who has no interest in Rwanda.
Two of the most important characters in 100 Days are Josette and Baptiste, both young lovers. Was this lover subplot a way of drawing people in?
You know, love is a universal theme. The audience, even if they're in Tokyo or Toronto, can immediately relate to the hopes and fears of that couple.
I'd like to share with you my reaction to the movie. It seemed to me that when you cleaved closest to the actual events, it had the most impact. And when you moved off to the plots that you had imposed to attract the audience, because the actors were frankly rather wooden, it was when my mind began to wander.
Indeed. I mean, none of the actors are professional actors, but they are Rwandan, and they were portraying something under whose shadow they lived and through which they had lived. I think it would be terribly wrong to have a full glossy Hollywood film made, because at that point, that's where you bring in all sorts of stories which have absolutely nothing to do with the genocide. And that's what's going to happen in the next year. There's going to be many films made about people who did little in the genocide or betrayed people in the genocide, and they're going to be presented as heroes. 100 Days doesn't do that.
And I was fascinated by your use of the extraneous characters who came through, the UN soldiers, the journalists. You have journalists, people holding cameras, just as you yourself did during the actual genocide, scattered all through.
Were they Tutsi?
I don't know. Yes, they were Tutsi.
Is that why they killed them?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Who were they?
They were friends. Mr. Cabera was not liked. He was in an opposition political party.
Is that why they killed him?
I don't know. Maybe.
They're generally in the way. They're irrelevant. They're taking no moral stand, and they have no impact on what's going on around them. It's as if they were dropped from the moon.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what happened. You had UN soldiers from the West You had aid workers, you had expats, you had journalists. All of them betrayed the Rwandan people. The media took absolutely no part in the genocide in it, exposing it to the international community. It brushed it off with cliches, caricatures. The aid workers, 99% of them, just got on the plane and left. The expats just left their servants to be slaughtered while they evacuated their dogs. And the UN, who were there to keep the peace, just ran away.
It's clear that you don't have much respect for those characters who wander through your story. You don't pay much attention to them at all. And yet you yourself, when you were there, videotaped a machete-wielding man beating a woman and her daughter, pleading for their lives, and it was broadcast all over the world in 1994. Do you think it did nothing?
Well, it was something very, very small. I mean, I didn't save anybody. I didn't put my camera down and save any children, and nor did anybody else, and nor did those people who sat at home and watched those two women being murdered, watching their television in Europe or America. Nothing happened. There was no great outcry for something to be done.
In an effort to tell your story in a way that would be popular and not cheapen or distort it, you tried to cleave a sort of middle course. You put in a love story, but you offered no redemption for any of the characters. There isn't anybody who is saved. There isn't anybody who isn't irreparably damaged. Here's a clip of a little girl talking to a UN soldier in front of one of the mass graves.
Did you see what happened?
They put all the Tutsis in the ground and in the pit latrines.
Did you know them?
My friend Etienne is there with his whole family.
If he was your friend, don't you miss him?
No, he belongs in a pit latrine. It's natural. He was a Tutsi. They killed all the Tutsis because Tutsis smell bad.
Given that the story ends on a note of absolute despair, is there any technique, including a love story, that you think would be able to keep the audience there?
There's nothing positive about genocide. You can't come out with some glimmer of hope. Genocide is all negative. It is all dark and evil. And the suffering that people go through is beyond imagination. But if there's some understanding and some sympathy, and there's some belief that Rwandans were human beings amongst an international audience, then that's a great step.
Nick, now that you made the film that you wanted to make, do you think you can find a way to forgive yourself a little bit?
Well, it's not really a matter of forgive.
I guess what I mean is,
yeah,
it's obvious that you came away with an enormous burden and a sense of responsibility that you don't feel you fulfilled and that the rest of the Western community in Rwanda certainly didn't fulfill. And you made this film. So my question is can you leave it alone now?
Well, the film gives me an opportunity to speak about Rwanda, but I don't get the opportunity to go back and stop by the side of the road and pick up a child who's going to be murdered by the Interahamwe and take him out of the country to safety. And nor does anybody else get that opportunity to do that again. And nobody said anything about stopping it happening next time. So, no, I don't think there is anything really to feel positive about or redeemed about. Not at all. The genocide is the opposite of redemption. There is no redemption. You can't go back. Those people are dead, and it will happen again.
Nick, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Nick Hughes is the director and co-producer of 100 Days. I spoke to him in 2002.
Coming up, A Lighter Shade of Pale, the psychology and the industry behind skin whiteners.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We just heard from a photographer who blames himself for failing to move the public when it mattered with his camera. But what if the camera itself is partially to blame? What if the instrument used to capture reality's various hues has a bias of its own? This is an ad for Kodak from 1988.
The world's great pictures are trusted to one film, Kodak. Why trust your memories to anything less?
But it turned out Kodak film couldn't be trusted to capture all our true colors. Photographer Sarita McFadden wrote in BuzzFeed this week that after her family sat for a group photo, she learned that the camera just couldn't see dark skin.
It was a big deal to go to this photo studio. It was in a completely different side of town. And my mom had saved up, planned our outfits. She wanted to get a proper family photo, as every mother would want to get. As a four-person family, my mother, my father, my younger sister, and myself, we're varying skin tones, but not so wildly off from each other. And then when the proofs came back, I hated every single one. I don't know if it was the background. I don't know if it was the choice of clothing we wore, but something looked off. My mom's a little bit washed out. And then on me, I'm kind of offside in shadow. My eyes totally obliterated.
Your face just sort of disappeared into kind of a muddy murk.
Yes. I heard similar things of folks feeling disappointed with portraits that they sat for or school photos. Brown tone seemed flattened to some sort of kind of washed out blob. I really became interested in how can I do this better? I could probably do this better.
And what you found out, essentially, was that the problem wasn't so much that the photographer was Caucasian, but that the film was.
Which is probably the most elegant distillation ever. Yes. It turned out that the film technologies that we were utilizing at the time in like the 60s, 70s, 80s, even up to the 90s, pretty much had been calibrated towards Caucasian skin tones.
To Shirley.
Shirley was a model working for Kodak in the beginning of them developing color film stocks for non-professional use. She's a Caucasian woman dressed in high contrast clothing who became the reference card for technicians and developers to calibrate how they would print color film stock. The first model was named Shirley. It kind of just stuck.
The film was calibrated to pick up lights and darks in a particular range. And so if you weren't in that contrast zone, you wouldn't be seen.
You wouldn't be seen. Eventually, when other companies started to utilize the color film for advertising their products, they discovered that the film's limited range also flattened their products. So that is when we start to see a shift in Kodak actually developing and enhancing that technology to try and read a wider variety of not only chocolate, but skin tones.
What did photographers do before? Photographers had been dealing with it.
Right. Everyone did it differently. If you look at Gordon Parks, primarily his entire photo career, everything is in black and white. You don't have the problem with the grayscale. So the grayscale, you get the most dimension and storytelling. Somehow we're able to evoke nuances about shades of brown and mood through the grayscale. One of the things that I thought was problematic about color film is that it flattened us. Like, if we're distorted in images, and those images are basically consumed by our culture, then perhaps this actually kind of shifts and adjusts the narrative of how people see us. There's a limit of imagination in terms of understanding black and brown identities in our culture. You know, just how darker-skinned people have been represented in images over, you know, decades. We're still kind of in this dialogue of trying to understand or fully see each other.
And the tendency to de-individualize black skin on film was noted by Jean-Luc Godard.
Yeah, in 1977, no less. He was commissioned by the Mozambique government to shoot some work for them. He refused to use Kodak film stock. He's noted that it does not render a defined blackness on those emulsions, which basically would flatten identity, would basically would present everyone as a mob. What I love about the work now with the modernization of technology and certainly our awareness is that we're able to capture a wider range of darker skin tones, able to capture details, we're able to capture undertones. McQueen's 12 Years a Slave, tough film to watch, but what's amazing is the way the enslaved Africans are lit and rendered. We get to see the nuances and varieties. There's a beautiful humanization of their personhood that is absent in our visual language of enslaved Africans from centuries before and how they were portrayed by the camera.
But you've also noted that there are some risks encoded in the digital photography, the point-and-shoot cameras that we use?
Yeah. All the cameras are calibrated differently. In 2010, there was this one image that went viral that this young woman posted about Nikon's Coolpix camera, which is made up of like a set of like smart technologies to give you the opportunity to recapture your moment. If you blinked because the flash burst, then we'll give you an opportunity to take the picture again so you can get your perfect shot.
Mm-hmm.
So the image that's going around is a screenshot of saying, wait, did someone blink? And she's like, no, I'm just Asian. The sensors must have been calibrated to the contours of a white face or a Caucasian face. It didn't take into account a variety of faces.
Are you taking pictures now in black and white or color?
I do shoot in color because I have control now.
Can you tell me when there was a moment when you, mm-hmm. as a photographer, just couldn't get what you wanted?
There was definitely an instance when I did some headshots in probably the like most ideal light situation. The client wanted these images in color and it still didn't read right. I think that's probably the official time that I broke up with Kodak forever. And that's when I started talking to photographers about other film stocks that I could try. And one of them suggested to me Fujichrome, Fuji Provia, actually, a very specific color film stock of slide film from Fuji that was gorgeous. And then I started playing around with cross-processing it. That basically entails taking a roll of color slide film and then running it through E6 and then C41. E6 is the kind of developer you use to develop slide film. So it becomes a positive image. And then you do C41 and it becomes a negative image. And those two processes skewed the color in a way that favored darker skin. Even if the colors are not true to how we experience it, there's something beautifully compelling and a richness and a vibrancy that very powerful for me. And I was thrilled to shoot it that way.
Sarita, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarita McFadden is a writer and photographer. Her piece in BuzzFeed is called Teaching the Camera to See My Skin.
Days before Lupita Nyong'o won an Oscar for 12 Years a Slave, she addressed a gathering of black women in Hollywood.
I received a letter from a girl, and I'd like to share just a small part of it with you. Dear Lupita, it reads, I think you're really lucky to be this black, but yet this successful in Hollywood overnight. I was just about to buy Densha's whitenicious cream to lighten my skin when you appeared on the world map and saved me. My heart bled a little when I read those words.
Arun Venugopal is the host of Micropolis, a series he made for our producing station, WNYC. This piece about the industry of skin whitening is called The Dark Side of Fair Skin.
You may not know what Densia's whitenicious cream is, but millions of people do. Lupita went on to acknowledge her own childhood insecurity about having dark skin and how she overcame it. The speech went viral. It all cemented her legend, especially with young black women. Just not this one.
I don't know her. Her story's her story. That's her personal life.
Lupita's antagonist, Densia, is an African pop star. She launched Whitenicious.
Whitenicious means, white means pure, but it doesn't mean that white skin, but white in general. That's how I look at it. It means pure.
Densia claims her lightening cream is flying off the shelves, succeeding not only abroad, but with African Americans. To those who think she's exploiting people's deepest insecurities, she says people should have a choice. This is the latest chapter in a long story, says Nina Jablonski, the author of Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color.
Skin lighteners were created in Reconstruction-era United States by former slaves who wanted to have lighter skin that they considered to be more socially acceptable, that would allow them to get better jobs and not be discriminated against.
Even as late as the mid-20th century, skin lightening held a sort of science fiction appeal for some civil rights leaders. Walter White was the head of the NAACP, and in 1949 he wrote, with great excitement, that a newly discovered chemical, hydroquinone, could hit the structure of society with the impact of an atomic bomb. Black people could pass as white. It could, in fact, conquer the color line. That's not how things worked out. But skin lighters, which started out in the U.S., then moved into sub-Saharan Africa and into East and South Asia. It's estimated that in the next 4 years, global sales of lighteners will hit $20 billion.
Alphonse does have white beauty.
Jablonski figures that the country with the biggest skin color fixation is South Africa. But she put India in second place. And the other day, I stepped into an Indian grocery store, Patel Brothers in Jackson Heights, where I met Dilshad Jiwani. She was just coming through the checkout with a bottle of Fair and Lovely. That's India's most famous skin lightener. In fact, the world's top lightener, the company claims, used by 1 in 10 women globally.
My mom uses this for a long time. Now I'm using it. And my daughter uses it too.
It's a family tradition.
Yeah.
Do you think you're treated differently or people look at you differently because you have...
Yeah, that's true. People look at you differently if your skin color is different, especially in America because they're fair and we have a dark skin. So we are treated badly. So I want to be looking fair too.
How do you think the treatment is different? I mean, how do you feel like they...
Especially when in the train, if you're sitting next to a white person, they just get up and sit somewhere else. It feels like insult. Since I'm white, they don't do that.
Oh, how sad. How sad. Yeah, well, you know, it's the cross that you bear.
Carrie Mae Weems, a visual artist and MacArthur genius, whose retrospective is hanging right now at the Guggenheim.
You know, I go to certain stores and I see African women buying skin lightening creams, you know, really just butchering themselves, just destroying themselves because they're cheap creams, ultimately, with hydroquinone. I mean, I use it, you know, as a developing agent in for photography, for Christ's sakes, right? But that's our issue, and we'll have to figure out ways of getting through it.
And that's what Weems has spent her artistic life, in part, exploring.
No one is ever simply black. Not the jet black blue boy who lives downstairs, right? Or the high yellow girl who lives over there, or the, you know, the low brown boy. Playing with these ideas of color and then sort of taking it out, you know, moving from high yellow to golden yellow to magenta color to violet that can be used as a discourse on almost the absurdity of color.
I tell Carrie Mae, in India, the obsession with light skin is still pretty intense. Just read the matrimonial ads in the newspaper or on websites. It's not at all unusual for people to advertise their fair skin, their daughter's fair skin. Fair? Wheatish?
Like, wheatish.
Kind of like wheat. Like, you're like,
oh,
not
like,
fair.
Like golden.
Yeah. It's like not as good as fair. But it's not as bad as dusky.
Every article of mine begins with dark and dusky. Earthy, you know, they have to kind of qualify.
Nandita Das is an Indian actress. She's had a career mostly in art films, despite her dark skin. And lately, she's become the spokesperson for a campaign against skin lighteners.
Fair and lovely rose lagane se do guna zyada gorapan paoge.
Wow, unbelievable.
Every ad is telling you if you're not fair, you can't get a job, you can't get a lover, you can't get a husband. You only see white women. And in a country which is 90% dark, it's bizarre to be having such a preference.
Dark is beautiful. India's campaign is a nod to the Black is Beautiful movement here in America in the 60s and 70s. It isn't unusual to hear darkness being celebrated, eroticized in American pop music. D'Angelo's Brown Sugar, Brown Skin Girl by India Arie, or Eric Benet's Chocolate Legs.
Please, baby, rip them chocolate legs, brown me.
You can't say the same about India or the rest of South Asia. The negative perceptions of dark skin are just so entrenched and they cut across caste and class. As for music, there's actually a word that comes up in countless Bollywood songs. Gori, meaning fair, a fair-skinned girl, a cutie, and in most of these movies, that's pretty accurate. She's probably cute, and she's certainly really light. In India, Dark is Beautiful is gaining traction, but it has a long way to go before people, especially women, become comfortable in their own skin.
I think that we're more open to the complexities and the diversities of blackness. The civil rights movement gave us that.
Carrie Mae Weems settled into her skin a long time ago.
How can you do serious work when you're like, you know, stumbling around trying to figure out whether or not I'm lighter, if I'm golden, if I'm yellow, if I'm red, if I'm, you know, and what that means? I can't get anything done if I'm trying to second guess your ass on a regular basis about what you might feel when I walk in the room.
Arun Venugopal is a reporter for our producing station, WNYC. You can listen to more Micropolis at WNYC.org. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Durkman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Cameron Lindsay, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.